Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to DW's Africa Link program, coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
With me, Jane Ayeko-Kumet. Coming up in today's program, it's World Refugee Day, and we take you to Uganda, which is considered a shining example when it comes to hosting refugees.
Uganda is like my country. All refugees working. The Uganda, we are feeling free. We are refugee and we are working. Don't have problem.
And at least 10 miners have been killed after a mine collapsed in Zambia's copper belt.
At this particular place, they were actually allowed to mine by the president, who made a declaration about a month ago. But then in terms of safety measures, there were no safety measures that were put in place.
And on the global stage, the US has pulled out of the UN Human Rights Council. We have all these stories and your reactions coming up after we hear stories from around the world.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said Germany will stick to its commitment of keeping Europe together. Speaking in Berlin on World Refugee Day on Wednesday, Merkel said more needs to be done to help the nearly 65 million people fleeing war and persecution.
The number of refugees worldwide is simply unthinkable, and people fleeing is a central global question of our time. However you cut it, migration is a European challenge, perhaps our greatest challenge at the moment. It is about the cohesion of Europe.
Merkel is expected to discuss European migration policies with her EU counterparts at a special mini-summit in Brussels on Sunday. An Italian Coast Guard ship carrying more than 500 migrants has docked safely at a port in Sicily after a long delay. The rescue comes after the new anti-immigrant Italian government last week banned NGO rescue ships from docking in the country. Far-right Italian Interior Minister Matteo Salvini accused the charities of being complicit with human smugglers operating in Libya. And Uganda President Yoweri Museveni held a press conference in Parliament today and said that his government would introduce a number of measures to fight crime. For more, we go to our Ugandan correspondent Alex Jita.
Women and children have mostly been victims of the current lawlessness in the country. To solve this, Museveni says his government was going to introduce a number of measures to fight crime, including street cameras and electronic number plates, and registration of all government guns.
These police of yours, they have the machine to read all the fingerprints of the guns. Why then are you not using it for all these murders? I ask them. The answer, we have not bothered to take the fingerprints of all the guns in Uganda.
Museveni's security address comes after the arrest of the country's former Inspector General of Police, General Kale Kaihura, a week ago. The general is accused of espionage and murder.
This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. South Sudan President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar arrived in neighboring Ethiopia on Wednesday for talks on ending the country's five-year civil war. The talks are the first meeting between the two warring parties since a peace deal fell apart in 2016. Tens of thousands of civilians have died in the bloody war in the world's youngest country. In Eritrea, President Isaias Afwerki said he would send a delegation to Ethiopia for peace talks. The president said during a speech in the capital Asmara that the decades-long rivalry with Ethiopia has reached a turning point. This comes after Ethiopia earlier this month announced it would fully accept the terms of a peace agreement with Eritrea, signed in 2000 to end the two-year border war that has killed tens of thousands. And now in World Cup football action in Russia, Portugal beat Morocco 1-0. Real Madrid star Cristiano Ronaldo scored from the corner, bringing his total so far to 4 goals. At halftime, Uruguay leads Saudi Arabia 1-0, and Iran takes on Spain later tonight. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
You're listening to Africa Link, your window to the story shaping the African continent. I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo. We are also live on Facebook, and you are more than invited to share your thoughts on the stories we are airing.
68.5 million, that's the total number of people that have been displaced worldwide. And as the UN marks World Refugee Day, Filippo Grandi, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, has called for solidarity with the refugees.
Refugees need to be included in new communities and given the chance to realize their potential. And solutions are needed to help refugees return home when the time is right, or build new lives elsewhere.
Head of UN Refugee Agency Filippo Grandi, and he paves the way as we head to Uganda, which has been labelled a model when it comes to integrating refugees. Michael Wambi visited a suburb in the capital, Kampala, nicknamed Little Mogadishu due to its largely Somali population, and sent us this report.
It is densely populated, but also highly entrepreneurial. The inhabitants of Little Mogadishu happily live together. You can barely tell a refugee from a national, and this has been the case. Here, you meet people like Muhammad Khalif. He has lived in Uganda for 2 decades and is the coordinator of the Somali Kisenya Association in Uganda.
Usually when it comes the refugee who live all over the world, I think Uganda is number one, who hosts all over the world, number one. Nobody can harass the refugee. Nobody asks the IDs. They can live like Ugandans. They can open the business wherever they want. They can rotate 24/7 the way they like. So that's why the Uganda, they become number one.
Before the Somali refugees settled in Kisenyi, it was a rust slum and workplace for artisan metal fabrications. Few of those still exist, but the streets are now bustling with business and trade. Traders here do not need to go uptown Kampala to exchange money. This place has more than enough forex bureaus, just as are hubs for long-distance buses. It is late afternoon. Nur Muhammad and her daughter Shukur Modin are in her shop. She flew her country several years ago and has found a new home here.
Uganda is like my country. All refugees working. The Uganda, we are feeling free. We are refugee and we are working. Yeah. Don't have problem. See, if a refugee is in their home, that is not good. Because I'm very lucky to work. Eh? I'm working here 9 years. And before, I was working from Somalia because I'm experienced from business.
A call to prayer is going down as I walk to City Supermarket. The lingua franca here is predominantly Somali. Here, I meet Dahir Muhammad, a Somali refugee formerly living in South Africa.
We are feeling happy and we don't have a problem with the Ugandans. They are giving the open hand, so the open heart. Yeah, I have been staying in South Africa 6 years, but I'm enjoying there, but I don't have family. But my family is here. That's why I'm living in 2017. I was living in South Africa. I've been there in many years in South Africa. There are same refugee ways, but here in Uganda, I'm enjoying with my family. That's why now I'm feeling more happy with than in South Africa.
The refugees are able to participate in Kampala's vast economy. Entrepreneurship offers them survival, with a large number of them being self-employed.
Michael Wambi with that report in Little Mogadishu. Now to Zambia, where at least 10 subsistence miners have died after a small-scale mine collapsed in Zambia copper belt city of Kitwe. Zambia is one of the world's largest copper producers.
That's right, Yeko, and the metal accounts for 80% of the country's export earnings. However, high levels of unemployment have pushed some to work in illegal mines. But as DW's correspondent in Lusaka, Kathy Shotex, reports, Zambia has poor safety standards in legal and illegal mines.
There are conflicting reports that between 10 and 20 miners, mostly young people, have died. And these are popularly known as Jerabos. And they do a lot of mining. And I must say that at this particular place, they were actually allowed to mine by the president, who made a declaration about a month ago. But then in terms of safety measures, there were no safety measures that were put in place. And this is just an open space that just has a lot of slag, and so, you know, it's very easy for someone to be buried alive. And we are also told that about 50 young people are missing. They are still looking for them. And about 7 of them are critically injured in hospital. I spoke to Mr. Nkole Chishimba, who is the president of the Mine Workers Union of Zambia, which is the biggest representative of workers in the mining industry on the Copper Belt.
There was a collapse of ground at the Black Mountain, where people have been given, I think they've been given about 10% of that area to mine. There are different groups, but you don't know exactly who the victims are. But the first thing we heard was that 20 were feared dead. So by the time I was in town, I heard that bodies are being retrieved.
President of the Mine Workers Union of Zambia, Nkole Chishimba, talking to our correspondent there, of course, Kathy Short in Lusaka.
Not a very pleasant story, Crispin, but we go to elsewhere in the world. The United States has pulled out of the UN Human Rights Council. During the announcement, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, accused the international body of hypocrisy, protecting abusers and chronic bias against Israel. Haley admitted that the U.S. had failed to convince any member country to overhaul the Human Rights Council.
And that decision to withdraw has been swiftly criticized by the head of the UN Human Rights Office in Geneva, Zaid Raad Al Hussein, as well as EU Chief Diplomat Federica Mogherini. Richard Reoch is a human rights defender who formerly worked with Amnesty International, and he told me he totally disagrees with the U.S. decision.
The history of human rights protection at the United Nations has been a record of exactly what she described, but to point the finger at others and not oneself is a kind of national self-delusion, you know? It doesn't point the way forward. It just continues a sort of a sad litany of making political attacks when things don't go your way.
But she does admit that the UN Human Rights Council, in so many ways, has failed to carry out its mandate, which is to uphold human rights around the world.
Well, it's not the Human Rights Council that has failed. It's not as if the Human Rights Council, you know, is an independent body which has the authority to tell states what to do and address all human rights issues. These are representatives of the governments. The United Nations is made up of governments. And if there is any question that needs to be asked, it's why are governments themselves failing to come up to the standards that they themselves have set?
Now, talking about this decision, what effect will it have on countries, let's say, in Africa or in Asia, that are doing badly in regard to human rights?
Well, first of all, I really want to just challenge you for a second there on this notion that human rights violators are only, you know, for example, in Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Middle East. You know, this is a global problem. Will it make that much difference that the UN withdraws from the Human Rights Council? At the present moment, I would say probably not. The United Nations is not going to collapse, and certainly the work of the United Nations Human Rights Council is not going to collapse. And at a certain point, the U.S. will be back there.
Human rights activist Richard Reoch. Now, Ayeko, to the
football time.
Football time. Let's leave the Human Rights Council and all their stories. It's football, and Morocco, unfortunately, has been bundled out of the World Cup by Portugal. Ronaldo again scoring one goal, and we have posted that story on our Facebook page. One man, Tan Labar, says he's good, but please stop this personality cult. When did football become an individual sport?
That's a good one, I think. But again, you can't deny the fact that all football is made out of personalities, and personalities make the game interesting.
Yeah, and again, he's good. Ronaldo is good. I mean, he's scored 4 goals now in 2 games. That's an average of two goals. So he is good. And I don't blame him for being so good.
Yeah, but it's his opinion. I mean, the person commenting, everybody's entitled to their opinion. But from my side, I think that football without names is no football, because everybody's looking forward to what is Ronaldo going to do. Yesterday, you had people talking about Mane there. Is he going to, you know, secure Senegal and so on? And of course, the whole team did a good job, I think.
That's right. Keep those comments coming on our DW Facebook page.
In case you've just tuned in, this is DW's Africa Link program coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo. And a reminder that we are also live on Facebook. Just visit DW Africa and drop us your thoughts on the stories that we are airing. And coming up in the next 15 minutes, how rearing catfish is providing employment for young Ghanaians in the north of the country.
Within a few years or time, definitely you come and see me as a fatty man, not as slim as you see me.
Interesting there, Crispin. Some catfish eating? And I do like catfish. What about you?
Well, not bad for me either. But anyway, don't miss out that story. But before that, we go to Addis Ababa, where South Sudan's warring leaders are meeting face-to-face for the first time in almost 2 years. President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar arrived on the invitation of Ethiopia following international pressure to end a conflict that has killed tens of thousands of people and displaced many others.
Machar fled South Sudan after new fighting erupted in the capital in July 2016, ending a brief attempt at peace. Since then, calm has barely been restored. DW correspondent Wake Simon Wudu has been following the story and has been telling me what could happen in the talks taking place in Addis Ababa.
What is on table is that the two leaders are expected to make discussions on some serious aimed at revitalizing the 2015 peace agreement.
Do you have any idea on some of the key issues or the pertinent issues that the two leaders will be discussing?
Well, according to one of the government officials this afternoon, Minister Awut Deng, who was traveling with President Kiir to Addis Ababa, she said some of the key issues President Kiir and Machar are expected to make breakthrough upon security arrangements and issues related to governance, especially issue in regards to dissolution of the parliament, according to the proposed IGAD bridging agreement. The parliament is supposed to be dissolved and reconstituted, and then new members are appointed by the parties. And then also the two leaders are expected to discuss and compromise on structure of the presidency. Like, for example, should South Sudan have a president and three vice presidents as proposed by IGAD, or it should only have like a president and a vice president? So these are some of the key issues delegates of the two leaders last month failed to make a breakthrough during their 3 days talks in Addis Ababa. So these two leaders are expected to discuss and make compromises on this.
Now, it's not the first time such a meeting is happening. What is different this time around?
Well, there is really not much difference. You know, as you said, it's not the first meeting. The two leaders have been meeting, and according to analysts, not much is expected from them. However, many view it as a good gesture, you know, by the two leaders trying to confirm their efforts in, you know, making sure that this current conflict comes to an end. At the meantime, what the citizens, the people of South Sudan, the civil society activists, including even both cycles within the government and the opposition groups, they really want the two leaders to meet. To them, they believe that their meeting can at least make them come with some action points that can try give people hope that at least the two are ready to compromise.
DW's correspondent Waki Simon Wudu in Juba with that update on what's happening in Addis.
That's right. And we asked you on Facebook, do you think both leaders can agree to terms for the sake of peace in South Sudan?
Some interesting responses here from different people. For instance, Chris Biafra says one of them meant well for the people while the other is being used to destroy his own country or his own people.
And Chanceman Arinaitwe says the problem of South Sudan is those two men. If they put their personal motives aside, South Sudan will be stable again.
Timo Tope says it's not the first time the two leaders are meeting. Let's just wait and see what comes around.
Mugumia Olan Omukakamu says that just fooling the general public while fulfilling their personal goals. Both should be summoned to the International Criminal Court.
Yes, keep those comments coming. Join the conversation, share your opinions. We will present them to the rest of the team. But you can also just engage on the debate.
On the spot.
Ghana is one of Africa's best examples when it comes to democracy. But the West African nation also has its share of challenges when it comes to youth unemployment. Despite the discovery of oil and the abundance of gold and other minerals, 1.2 million people are unemployed, most of them young people.
Now, Ghana's President Nana Akufo-Addo recently declared the youth unemployment rate a threat to the country's national security. So, instead of waiting around to get formal employment, some young people have opted to start raising catfish for sale. As Maxwell Souk now reports from the Coastal Belt, more and more of these youngsters are hoping to cash in on the aquaculture industry. Take a listen.
Pond manager Moro Shaibu Sepa is feeding his 5.5-month-old catfish. He has a broad smile on his face. He is already anticipating a good harvest from these fish, who are growing well.
I have about 4 ponds here, somewhere over there. Well, after this, we are going to restock it again.
After just 6 months, these fish are ready to eat. When Moro Shaibu harvests the ponds, it is enough to sustain his household for half a year, he says.
It's about 6 months. They are 5.5 kilograms now. Yeah.
Osman Amadou is 33 years old. Osman is a teacher and on the side works at rearing fish too. Although he is still hoping that one day he might find work in the oil and gas sector.
Oh, it was my expectation to be employed there, but it was not solely because of the amount that you get there. But you know, over here in Ghana, when you are a teacher, you are not even much recognized. Even the placement has given much recognition than you. Yes.
Moro Shaibu and Osman Amadou belong to the Alhamdulillah Fish Farmers Association at Kanguni, a community in the Elembele district of the Western Region. Now he struck gold with catfish.
And recently I went to Akosombo to be trained as a hatchery operator to be able to hatch the fish. Within a few years or time, definitely you come and see me as a fatty man, not as slim as you see me.
The catfish arrived at just the right time. Marine fishing is declining by 12% annually in the area, according to the Fishery Commission. Ghana is now importing more fish than its fishes. At the moment, most of the catfish is being consumed locally. But as the industry picks up, the hope is that Ghana can start exporting its catfish too. Back at Kanguni, Moro Shaibu still has a big smile on his face. It beats mining any day, he thinks.
It's better than the galamse. It doesn't involve any risk. I'm here, I will come to the pond in the morning by 8 o'clock, I'll come and feed them. And the afternoon, 1 o'clock, I'll come and feed them. 5 o'clock in the evening, I'll come and feed them. Then I'm going home.
Despite his joy, the rest of the population are slow to follow Moro Shaibu's lead. The majority are still hoping that they can land a white-collar job in the oil and gas sector. But if the catfish keep eating at the rate they are, they might be about to change the perception of aquaculture very soon.
DW correspondent Maxwell Souk.
Living Planet Africa.
Now, plastic bags may be an easy and cheap way to carry goods, but their effect on the environment is enormous and has become a global concern. Several African countries, such as Rwanda and Kenya, have taken initiatives to ban the plastic bags.
Malawi tried to impose the ban, but faced strong opposition by manufacturers who took to the High Court to contest it. Unfortunately for them, the High Court upheld the decision. Iri Maka Jr. with this report by Miriam Kaliza.
Chanju Tembo has just finished her shopping. She's carrying her goods in several thin plastic bags. With the High Court upholding the ban on such plastic bags, people like Tembo will have to devise other means to carry their goods. But unlike those opposing the decision, Tembo thinks it is a good move.
I don't understand why the shops are still giving us plastic. As consumers, we kind of have no option when we go into shops but to buy the plastics because they are the ones that are available. If the scientists are saying it's bad, it's destroying our environment, then we have to stop to using them.
And Tembo is not alone. Lilongwe resident Joseph Namasala also agrees and says people should adapt to the change.
If the government and the organizations which are concerned together with the citizens, we can sit down and discuss about this issue so that we can conserve our environment.
The Association for Environmental Journalists has been spearheading awareness on the issue. Charles Mkoka is the general secretary.
It has been a challenge. If you move around most of the dumping sites, you see that there are a lot of disposals of these plastics that are just being deposited, one to another. Plastics, by nature of their creation, they are not biodegradable, they cannot decompose. So they have a bearing into the environment, they have a bearing into plants and animals, but also they also affect human beings indirectly.
According to Taunga Mbale Luke, the Director of Environmental Affairs, government is ramping up awareness campaigns to educate people about the dangers of plastics. She's optimistic that the manufacturers will adopt new alternatives that government has been proposing, such as paper bags or thick plastic bags.
There are a lot of hazards that are associated with plastics, and that is why it is of importance that we must do something to ensure that we reduce or we even stop, just to request people to refuse to use plastics and use the alternatives. And also to help raise awareness, as agents of change, so that people are aware of the effects of the plastics and put in place measures to stop the use or reduce them.
Malawi's plastic bag ban is not the first one of its kind. Most African countries, such as Rwanda, Kenya, Uganda, and South Africa, have also banned the use of thin plastics.
Eddie Micah Jr. with that report by Miriam Kaliza.
Yes. Now, Crispin, I go to take you to Africa's most populous nation, and there is a developing story there. And it is that Nigeria could borrow its stolen Benin bronzes back from Western museums rather than demand a full return. Now, other governments, including Ethiopia, Greece, and Greece have rejected the idea of loans and demanded full returns, saying they should not have to borrow their own stolen property. London resists, on the other hand, resists this full return due to legislation that bans its museums from permanently depositing of their collections. We asked you on our Facebook page, so what could make Nigeria settle for borrowing what rightfully belongs to them from London? And you've been commenting.
Right. Emmanuel Etornam Kuma says Nigeria should borrow them and never return them. That's all.
That's a good advice. I hope the Nigerians are listening. And Samuel G. Sam says a thief making law to protect him or himself, that's a thief with no shame.
Olisa Ojuku says we are taking it back through borrowing. Very sarcastic.
Yeah, and Jay Ate says their law permits stolen items, but ours does not. Oh, what a world of hypocrisy. Africans, please better sit up.
And a very, very interesting comment here from Presh Ndubuisu Uchebua, and he says our colonial masters, they taught Nigerians how to steal.
I think it's based on the fact that there's been a lot of talk about corruption in Nigeria. And of course, the president committing to fight corruption, and there's this whole talk whether or not he's actually living up to his campaign promises. Abdallah Abubakar says, how should we borrow something that belongs to us? It was stolen by the Western world, and he puts in brackets Britain. They should pay ransom because it wasn't taken for safekeeping, but rather stolen against our wish. So many of those comments there, Crispin. People are really pertinent about
these
issues.
And it is quite surprising. And I think most of them do have a point, saying that, you can't borrow what was previously yours. But at the same time, Britain is here saying, well, we have laws and we can't just let them go just like that.
Yeah. Samali Kabal is still on the same issue, says there is nothing like borrowing what's rightfully yours. These colonizers have for so long profited from other people's culture. Brits are thieves. Those are her comments.
Well, thank you very much for those comments and for listening to us this day. I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
And I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet. Have a nice day.